welcome to the American Churchman podcast. I am not John Harris, but it doesn't mean you should turn it off immediately. I am related to him. I am his brother. I'm the director of TrueScript, and I am pinch hitting for him today, as always, or unless we have a significant Category 5 hurricane. Matthew Pearson is here with us tonight. Matt, how are you doing?
I am doing great, David. As always, it's always a pleasure to be here, and it's even a greater pleasure to have you on now. It's kind of funny how last week I was not able to make it because I was stupid enough to go down to Tampa during the hurricane. So that was that was fun. But yeah, John recommended I probably shouldn't do the cast, and I was going to cancel anyways. But it's funny how you two did it, and now he's gone, and I'm here. So, but yeah, it's good to see you. Good to be with you for this cast. I'm excited.
Absolutely. I don't think you were stupid at all. I was texting with my father-in-law who lives in Florida and telling him, listen, I'm coming. I don't want to miss it. But I don't know. I'm weird like that as well. When there's significant weather events, I have a deep, I hope, masculine urge to be present for them. Like, I need to experience them with everyone else, which, by the way, you're going to get into an attribute of God. But something about storms that's always struck me and how it relates to sort of the attributes of God is a storm, especially like a big storm, is a strange thing because there's this thing that you have a fear of it because of the power, but you also kind of desire it. Like, you want to see the power, and that's sort of like the Lord. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to talk about the unity of God. Can you tell us a little bit about the unity of God?
Absolutely. I will do my best. I just also want to let the audience know, every time we go through these, I do so with fear and trembling, because attributes of God are something incredibly important to know, but they're also something very important to get right. So whatever you hear me talk about, I would highly recommend just looking into it yourself as well, because not just like fact check me, make sure that I don't spout any heresies, but these are just so important for helping us contemplate who God is, and just showing us the glory of God. There's a C.S. Lewis quote in the beginning of On the Incarnation with Athanasius, where he talks about how it's oftentimes like it's not from the devotional books that he really feels the closest to God, but sometimes it's just sitting in his chair, smoking a pipe, and reading some hard-hitting theology where he feels the closest. And I definitely can relate to that. So just for your own faith, study these as well. They're good. But our attribute today is going to be the unity of God, or as I like to term it just for ease, divine unity. So before I even define this or get into what this is, I'm just going to read three short Bible verses for us. The first one is Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, where the scripture says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord." Next one is Isaiah chapter 44, verse 6, where the scripture says, "Thus saith the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first, and I am the last, and beside me there is no God." And those were both from the Old Testament. So our final verse, we could do a few more verses out of the New Testament, but I really like this one. It's from Ephesians chapter 4, verses 5 through 6, where the scripture says, "One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all." So essentially, when we talk about divine unity, what is unity? Unity is a sort of, there's oneness there. Unity is the opposite of plurality. Unity is one. So when we talk about divine unity, remember how a few weeks back we had discussed on the cast, John and I, at least, we had discussed divine simplicity, that God is not, he's not a composite thing. He's not like, this is a part of God, this is a part of God, this is a part of God, and when you put them all together, you have God. No, each of the attributes which God possesses, each of these attributes are God. So God does not have love. God does not have the greatest amount of love. God is love, and so forth with the rest of his attributes. So when we think about divine simplicity in relation to divine unity, we have to know that by virtue of God's simplicity, he is undivided. So God is not made of parts. He's undivided. And because God is undivided, he is one. So to get into a bit of a more complicated definition of divine simplicity, because these are something that we have to do, I kind of put together this little definition using primarily Richard Moeller's Dictionary of Latin and Greek Theological Terms. This is excellent, especially if you're a seminary student, which we'll be discussing that topic very shortly. But Richard Moeller, I basically try to condense it down as best as I can. He basically talks about how the doctrine of divine unity is this idea that God ought to be understood to be one in an absolute sense due to there being no other God. And this one God is an absolute unity incapable of division. So there is no other God. God cannot be divided. When we talk about God, God alone exists as God. So that's why we always capitalize a G in God, because he is like no other. When you see a lowercase g God, they're not even in the same category, because there is no genus in God where you can label all these various species or whatever I can phrase in other scholastic gobbledygook ways. But all that to say, God is one. Hermann Bavinck says of this, that there is but one divine being, that in virtue of the nature of that being, God cannot be more than one being, and consequently, that all other beings exist only from him, through him, and to him. Hence, this attribute teaches God's absolute oneness and uniqueness. And then for our final little quote for me to riff off of to read from regarding this, we're going to go to Thomas Aquinas, where he says in his Summa Theologica, he says, God, this is an objection, basically, in which he is answering, saying why it is that God has to be, there only has to be one God, and why other gods cannot exist. He writes that God comprehends in himself the whole perfection of being. If then many gods existed, they would necessarily differ from each other. Something, therefore, would belong to one, which did not belong to the other. And if this were a privation, so if one of them was lacking something, one of them would not be absolutely perfect. But if a perfection, one of them would be without it. So if one of them was perfect, another God would be without it. And so you can't have multiple gods for this very reason. So he continues saying, so it is impossible for many gods to exist. Hence also the ancient philosophers, constrained as it were by truth, when they asserted an infinite principle, asserted likewise that there was only one such principle. So God is in a unique category where he alone is the one God. And this is grounded in the fact that he is simple. He is not made up of parts. There is no other being like him. God's being is one and one alone, and there is only one divine being. And this is just going over the unity of God. This isn't going over unity in relation to the Trinity. That's a whole other conversation we can get into, though. David, you and I could discuss that a little bit if you feel like doing so. But that's basically divine unity.
How do we sort of fit the concept of Trinity into the concept of God being unified?
That's a great question.
The word might be reconcile. I don't know if that's the right word, but how do we sort of jive those things together?
Yeah. So the way in which you, the two big like stumbling blocks for this idea of divine unity in regard to the God of the universe, like the God of the scriptures, is two things, two primary doctrines, which are key to our faith, is the Trinity and the incarnation. So when it comes to the Trinity, what you have to realize is that there is only one divine being who is a unity, and these persons are not their own beings. They are simply different. The way in which you conceptualize them is you differentiate them by their relations to one another. So you don't divide them, they're united. You distinguish them. So we distinguish the Father from the Son and from the Spirit. So we know that the Father is he who begets the Son. That's how we distinguish Father and Son. And we know that the Son is begotten of the Father. And we know that the Spirit proceeds from the Father alone, if you're Eastern Orthodox, or if you're a Western Christian, aka correct, from the Father and the Son he proceeds. And so these are ways in which we distinguish the persons who are still united in their very essence or being. They share the same divine nature, and thus they are not divided. So that's how we would sort of work our way through the Trinity in regard to divine unity, is by the fact that we distinguish the persons, but we do not divide or separate them from one another.
And within our Protestant context, obviously, it's the sort of the framework that we're approaching is we're taking everything within scripture and being so careful to not go beyond it really in any way. One of our directors, Russell Fuller, Dr. Russell Fuller, who is professor at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, talks a lot about this, I know, in just the trying to make very, very certain. I mean, to the point that he's actually made me afraid to just almost afraid to talk about the Trinity, at all, which, it, you know, we shouldn't be because it's so clear in scripture. But just even by way of analogy, like even when we're trying to come up with analogy to explain the Trinity, to not go beyond what's clearly presented in scripture or add to that understanding in a way that maybe it helps, you know, make sense to us, but isn't, you know, necessarily orthodox. The thing that comes to mind, I don't know if you'd remember this, you probably would have been maybe in your early teens, but there was a book that came out called The Shack. You remember The Shack? And it was really big in the evangelical world. It was huge. And I know at the church I went to, a bunch of people kind of started reading it, and oh, this book is great, it really explains stuff. And some of the people in our church started to read it, and they're like, this is taking the analogous, it's taking the analogy so far that it's like, it's really treading into like blasphemy. And so just being careful whenever we're trying to explain, these concepts absolutely. That are so integral to our understanding of God.
And it's just so important because because of who it is we're talking about. We're talking about God, and we need to be very careful with how we speak of him, which is kind of why even before I got into this attribute, I was just saying I do so with fear and trembling because a great God of which we speak, who has so in his grace and mercy deigned it something right to reveal himself to us in his word. You can know from the created world and nature that there is a God out there, but it's only through his condescending to us through divine revelation or through special revelation that you know that this God is triune. And so we have to be very careful when we speak about this. These things, that's why they were so hotly debated in the early church. This is why there were anathemas placed on those who didn't get this right or who erred, because this is God we're talking about. If you worship the wrong God, there is no salvation. So it's very important.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff. All right, so let us get into some of our pieces for this week. Let me just share the TrueScript website with all y'all. I don't just want me. Oh, now it's just me with no one else on. There we go. All right, that's what I was looking for. Guys, I don't normally host this, but everyone's got to get their feet wet. So let's look really quick at this piece. Matt is not going to have quite as much to say probably about it because he is a single guy at this point, which has there's a valuable perspective there. I'm going to just plug this piece a little bit. This is from a guy named Jonah Hewer. He's a young man who lives up in Minnesota, and he's written several pieces for us. But he asked the question in this article, should marriage and children wait until I'm established? And I'm married. I have two kids, so I'm sort of, this is already determined for me. Matt, these are things that you will probably be thinking about. And the thing that kind of struck me as I was first going through this was just the fact of how much has changed in what it means to be established. So Even if I just go back to when I got married, so I got married 8 years ago, being established, so especially economically, was a lot easier. it was a lot more straightforward in a lot of ways. When I got married, we waited about 5 years to have kids, and we were deliberately waiting for about 5 years. And then we were kind of like, all right, we should go ahead and have kids now. And I don't know if I would say I regret so much as, wish we had just started having kids earlier, because we were very young and we had a, you know, there was a lot of freedom and it was really, really great. Like we really enjoyed being a young married couple. But children have made our lives so much, have just made our lives so vibrant. Like they've really added so, so much. So he says in the beginning here, establish is a word that's frequently used when family questions are discussed. Young people are advised to establish themselves before considering getting married and having kids. After all, how could an inexperienced, naive, know-nothing 20-something possibly manage the responsibilities that come with a family? And I know for me, especially when I was in college, the predominant, really what most people my age, the pressure that they sort of had was you need to finish college. You absolutely need to be done with college before you even think about getting married. You really need to be established in a career. So you can't just be, kind of doing a side job or something that like you need to have a real career. You need to you need to have medical insurance. There's sort of a list of things that you absolutely need to have. Many of which in the past, it actually might've been, you need to have a house. And now even people in their 30s, maybe even their 40s are kind of like, man, I sure hope one day I can have a house. I know that's me and my wife. What Jonah sort of talks about here is how the default assumption is that you wait to have kids. And that's just a given. And my wife was 20 when we got married. So she got a lot of, from extended family, from our immediate family was very supportive, but extended family and a lot of friends. So we're in upstate New York. People thought she was insane. Like, you are crazy getting married at 20. It's, I think one person said, like, you're going to throw your life away like that. You're throwing your life away by getting married young. And that was before before we even had kids. But that's sort of become the default assumption. So Jonah talks about in this piece about how they kind of like, they started having kids and they didn't feel prepared for it, but he has a good little quote here. He says, a few months later, so this is after he had already gotten married and they found out they were going to have a child. So a few months later, at a get together with several men from my church, one of the guys asked me how it felt to be expecting a child. Our pastor was there and challenged me to answer in 17 words or less. That was the limit he taught to adhere to for sermon summaries. He was joking, but I accepted the challenge, and eventually I came up with this. There's no such thing as established. There's only the challenge and God's grace to face it. So I think he makes a good case that marriage, but especially having children within marriage, man, children are a blessing. I cannot describe to how... I used to come home from work. I'm a teacher. So I used to come home from work every day and my wife would usually be at work and I would just do whatever. I would, hang out with a buddy or maybe I'd read a book or something. When I come home now, I have a little 2-year-old that runs and goes, "Daddy!" and runs. And it's an unparalleled feeling because I think because it's the fulfillment of a role that God has designated to me as a father that he's prepared, especially for me and really for all men who get married. So I would commend that piece. I don't know if you had the chance to read that, Matt, if it made you think at all about that situation. You're in the thinking about going ahead. I'm just curious, you're a little younger than me. What pressure have you noticed, especially from like the world, but even within the church, what is the expectation, if that makes sense, when it comes to marriage, but especially kids?
Yeah, I did get the chance actually to read the piece. It was pretty brief, but I enjoyed it. And I actually related to it quite a bit because there was this girl that I was dating for about 3 years in college. And I remember us discussing marriage like about a year and a half in. And she was like, yeah, I tried to talk to my dad about it. And he was like, nope, not until he is making at least 50K, then I'll give him permission, basically. And that lingered for like the rest of it. And eventually, because of that, we had to call it quits because we just realized like, look, that's just with what I want to do and the time frame and things like that, it's just not going to work. So we eventually had to call it quits because of that. So I've definitely experienced that as well. But there is this expectation, you know, you have the one side of things where it's like, a lot of people are like, just get married young, you know, start pumping out babies. That's good. And like, you know, I definitely would agree that, like, if you have the opportunity to marry, if that's the providential circumstance in which God has placed you, you're where you're with like a godly young woman and you two are able to do that, and you're not fully established, by all means, you know, don't, put yourself in a circumstance where you like date for 8 years or something without getting married, because that's just, that's unnecessary and will obviously lead to issues and whatnot. But on the other side, you do have people that are very much like, due to the economy being so bad and all these other things, they do want you to get established. And I've definitely kind of seen both sides. And as I said, with my personal anecdote, I've experienced the latter quite a bit. I've heard a lot about that. So, it is something I've thought a lot about, and kind of just thinking, like looking at my bank account as it dwindles from paying tuition and rent. And I'm just like, man, if I find a girl or something, hopefully I can be able to get something going. I don't know. But I'm very blessed in that I have a very supportive family. So I think that, you know, if the Lord placed someone in my life for that, with what I have, and, you know, I'm probably going to get a job soon, you know, well, I'll keep looking right now. But, one that works with my, my seminary schedule, of course. But you know, I'm not really too nervous about it in the future. I think it's good to, get married young and all that. But, you know, at the same time too, there are benefits towards being single, you know? And so if you don't have someone right now, and, you know, I'm 23 and, you know, I'm kind of just chilling. I'm not really like, I'm not necessarily dying right now. It would be nice. Yeah, of course. but you know, like you can take advantage of where God has placed you. But I would definitely say, yeah, if you have someone, that's probably a good thing to pursue because there are good things that come out of it. Actually, my roommate that I have is a really good friend of mine. Actually met him through Twitter, funny enough. But we've been hanging out like a lot in person for the past year. And, but yeah, we're roommates, and I have two other roommates besides him, and those two roommates are his wife and their 1-year-old daughter. And it's great, honestly, just seeing that dynamic. And we're not tired of each other, so that's good. But his daughter is very sweet. She likes me a lot, so that's nice. I make funny noises at her, and it makes her laugh and smile. And it definitely, I'm just like, yeah, this is cool. I'll you know, Lord willing, I'll have that. So it'll be good. But I thought it was an excellent article. It helped illuminate a lot of stuff for me. I know that was a bit of a long-winded answer to your question, but I definitely have seen what you described with discouragement towards getting married young, especially personally in my life with a past relationship that I've been in.
Yeah, you make a good point, and I can relate. I didn't get married till I was in my mid-20s. So my first, especially when I was 19, especially like 19, 20, 21, those were the most exciting years of my life. I mean, I was in Southern Africa. I was able to travel all over the place. There were a lot of really significant benefits to being that age and not being married for me. But I think you're kind of hitting on something. So from the world, you'll sort of get a pressure of, you know, it's all about you. So you need to make your marital decisions and your children decisions, right? Family planning. You need to make it basically all about you. Mm-hmm. When you get married, first thing you realize is, oh my goodness, this is not about me. This is about sanctification. It's a blessing, but it's work. It takes a lot of work, and it changes, you know, what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 7 is very true. You now have worldly concerns, and not that that's bad. It's marriage is he who finds a wife finds a good thing. But the temptation, I think, because we live in an age of, John talks about this a lot, but we live in an age of ideology. The temptation is to just run to the other side and say, well, everybody needs to be, everybody, right? We need to get everybody married by 19 or 20 or whatever it is. If you're not married, you need it. And the fact of the matter is God calls different people to different things. And I know we didn't mean to go as long on this piece, but my best friend passed away when he was 25. He died in a hiking accident. He had just recently broke up with a girl, right, like a couple months before he died. And he, this is a guy who really wanted to be married. He wanted to have kids. He used to say his dream was, you know, I want to get married so I can come home and play football with the kids. And I almost would like make fun of him for it and say like, oh man, that's kind of lame. Like, don't you want to, you know, don't you want to be a mercenary in a foreign country or something, you know?
So and, true.
He died. He's with Christ now, completely unexpectedly, but it was not God's will for him to get married. It was God's will for him to be a single man and to die that way and to be a testimony for others. So, you know, God calls us to different things. And I think that's very important to remember, especially when we're talking about marriage. And I would especially say that for, you know, maybe older people in the church who, you may have lived a certain way, or you may have, things may have been a certain way when you were going through that stage, and it may be different now. You know, God's calling, which is what we're going to get into now, may not be the same for everybody. So, sort of using that as a, I don't know if there's anything else you want to say about that, but using that as a segue into this next piece that I'm going to pull up about seminary. And I want to, is there anything else you want to say?
No, I think that we can move on. I think we're in a good spot now. Yeah.
So let's go to a probably more controversial piece. So I want to just do a really quick disclaimer. I actually want to explain why we published this piece at all, because I don't want anyone thinking that we are that this is True Script taking a position of slamming seminaries, because we're not. We have people who are on seminary boards, on our director. So that's not at all what we're trying to do. My intention, and I've been corresponding with the author of this for a little while, is to sort of bring to light and to have cause for, I think, discussions that probably need to happen, but aren't necessarily. There's what I notice is there's sort of a there's a little division, not a little, it's a big division between often the between church leaders and those filling the congregation. And I think this is because this is the same. If you look all throughout society, for lack of a better word, expert class, there's a lot of dissonance between the expert class and the people who are not, you know, sort of, I guess your average layman in a multiplicity of fields. Obviously we see that most in the political realm, but we see it during COVID, we saw it in the medical community. We see sort of two different, what often become echo chambers. And my sort of interest is to, you know, hopefully create a bridge. And that I don't even necessarily agree with everything in here. I know you don't, but we're going to discuss it and talk about it and bring some of these things to light. So this piece is called The American Sanhedrin. I'm going to read the first two paragraphs, and then I'm just going to launch into a couple of questions. So the author's name is Alan Gertensen. Sorry. In the Bible, we find a young man named Timothy. He grew up in a believing family. He came to love the Lord at a young age. Timothy couldn't imagine a life where every waking minute wasn't dedicated to the service of the church. One day, Timothy told his youth pastor about his burning desire for ministry. For the rest of his young life, his church looked forward to the day when they could send Timothy off to be educated at the seminary in Jerusalem. After graduation, Timothy responded to a call from a small church in Africa that he'd never heard of. Timothy spent his first few years at that church learning the troubles of trying to lead older people. He held a few successful conferences, leveraging his contacts back in Jerusalem to periodically get a big name to come out from seminary there. He moved every 5 to 10 years, beginning the same cycle and generally having a mostly uneventful ministry until he was in his mid-50s. I'm just going to finish up with this paragraph. It was at this time that Timothy committed a disqualifying sin. His congregation was crushed at the revelation of another fallen evangelical leader who seemed so solid for so long. Do you remember that story? Does it represent how disciples have always been made since the earliest days of the Great Commission? Is that the biblical story? or the modern version. Remember in 2 Timothy 2:2 where it says, entrust these things to untested boys who seem to be on fire for Christ in youth group somewhere else and got a certificate from a seminary you agree with, right? So dripping with sarcasm and very, very, very tongue-in-cheek. If it's not clear, sort of what this piece is saying is that the way that Timothy was trained is not the way that men are trained today. So to sort of launch into this, Matt, you are a seminary student now. Can you talk for a minute about why you decided to go to seminary?
Well, I decided to go to seminary because I felt there was an internal call towards the ministry, which was then externally validated by my pastors and elders. And so the way in which you go about getting a being able to pursue ministry within the context of the PCA, the Presbyterian Church in America, is, well, you have to have a seminary degree and show the session when you eventually go up to get ordained, or, you know, if you're going to go under the care of the presbytery prior to ordination, that you're either, so for going under care, show that you're at least getting theological education or basically like guaranteed to do so. And then getting ordained, you need to have a sort of theological education, which just happens to be done through the seminary system. So I decided to do that. Something about the seminary I'm at Reformed Theological Seminary, Orlando, and I'm from Tampa, Florida. So actually part of my decision in choosing that was not only, I do think it's an excellent seminary with a lot of great professors. I'm a big fan of Dr. Scott Swain and Dr. Michael Allen, and not just because they teach me, I was a fan before, because it's just, it was in Florida. So that played a big part of it, which I know a lot of the guys that are more anti-seminary, they kind of go, oh, well, you're just shipping them off somewhere. And I was like, no, I'm only 2 hours from home. I go home every 3 weeks so my dad can give me a haircut and I can have dinner with my family and things like that. But yeah, I went there because that is what is required. But not only that, you know, to get a theological education, I'm largely self-taught theologically. And I think that's a perfectly good way to go about. I mean, with the amount of resources that we have now due to the internet and due to all the publishing companies, it's good. But, you know, I do want to learn there and I do want to grow in wisdom and knowledge. And just by virtue of my what's before me, what my path is, I thought seminary would be the best way to go about that in order to get ordained. So that's sort of my reasoning. I want to be able to grow in knowledge of God. And we'll probably touch on this more as we go through the article, but I didn't necessarily go to seminary because, oh, that's a place where I may learn how to be a pastor. Now, that is going to be taught there. That is something important. There should be professors there that are also pastors. If none of your professors are pastors, that does concern me a little bit. But that's not the primary reason. And the reason why that's not my primary reason is because I think the best way that you learn how to be a pastor is not necessarily in the academic context, but more so it's going to be in an ecclesial context, in the context of a local church, which is why so many seminaries require a certain amount of field hours at a local church where you're a pastoral intern who, if you're a Presbyterian, is under the care of a presbytery. That's my reasoning, basically.
So I'm going to talk for a second about why I chose not to go to seminary. And for direct context, I've toured a number of seminaries, and the last one that I did tour with the potential to attend was RTS Oviedo. Where you go now? I was there a few years ago, and I considered moving to Oviedo from New York and attending. And I wanted to go. So with me, circumstantially, the reason why I didn't go there specifically, because I took a tour of the school, I talked to a bunch of people who knew a ton of things, and I was like, I wanted to learn Greek and Hebrew. I wanted to study Christian history from roughly the year 500 to the year 1500, because I always felt like the church history kind of regimen that I got from, you know, from Sunday school from the beginning was, you know, there was the disciples and there was the apostles and there's Paul and then there's the church in Rome and Constantine makes Christianity legal. Nothing happened for 1,200 years. Then Martin Luther and Calvin. Yeah.
Well, no, Augustine happened, and then Martin.
Oh, that's right, Augustine. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I had a good conversation with a guy at RTS, and I was kind of like, "I know stuff happened. I want to know what happened." So I decided not to go because a lot of it was circumstantial. I was already married, and I wasn't interested in a degree. I already had a master's degree. I didn't feel the need to add more credentials, to take, basically to spend a bunch of money to get a credential, to study something that I knew I could study if I just found, the right. But if I found somebody like Dr. Fuller, who now teaches, he has his own theology classroom, I knew I could find somebody. And then the Hebrew, I wound up working at an Orthodox Jewish school, like very shortly after. And I was like, well, if I wanted to learn Hebrew, I suppose they could teach me Hebrew. I mean, it'd be kind of weird, but I suppose it's possible. But I agree with what you're saying about pastoral ministry. So for a seminary to be pastoral ministry, and I think that may be where some of the disconnect comes in, where a lot of seminaries, I mean, a lot of seminaries have, Harvard was a seminary, right? I think Yale was a seminary.
Yep.
These places Yale started as, these were institutions to train people for pastoral ministry, and they still had divinity schools, but it's just, like it says in Ecclesiastes, the writing of books is endless. That's sort of what they've fallen into. Obviously eventually they apostatized and there's really nothing Christian going on in those institutions. Mm-hmm. But I realized sort of that I'm the son of a pastor. I grew up in a pastor's home, and I realized pretty early on that pastoring was about 80% counseling. And I'm like, I don't think I got the patience for this. Like, I don't know if I can sit down. I got my own problems. I don't know if I can do that. But I definitely would not, be closed off to it for the future. But I had already, I had the good fortune of, in providentially was raised in a home where I was taught theology. I was taught the Bible from a very young age at a pretty deep level. So I got the chance to audit some seminary when I was in my late teens at a seminary in South Africa. And by the time I got to the point to my late 20s where I was like, all right, I guess I could, I was interested in military chaplaincy. I thought maybe I can even go to seminary because I'll have to get an MDiv to become a military chaplain. By the time I got to that point, I was kind of like, well, I've already, if I plug into a church, I can serve, God willing, maybe one day I can be an elder. I can serve the church in that way, but I'm a layman. I'm not a pastor currently. I don't have any, I don't have any opportunities, and I don't feel really a calling in that way, which we'll discuss a little bit more. But just to kind of get a little bit back into this particular piece. So he writes in this piece. I just
want to
put
it up on the screen.
Sure. Yeah. Let me.
Okay.
I'm very techie. I also can't talk.
It's called John. Have him put it on the screen.
It was at this time that Timothy committed. Oh, not there. I'm sorry. All right. So 2 Timothy 2:2, where it says, entrust these things to untested boys who seem to be on fire for Christ in youth group somewhere else and got a certificate from a seminary you agree with. So I just put in the notes, discuss. There was one thing that this did kind of get me to think a little bit about. It's something that I noticed definitely in my teens. And I would be curious if you saw this as well. I think didn't you go to a larger church when you were growing up?
Yes, I attended a mega church.
Okay. All right. Perfect. So then you may be able to kind of speak to this even more, because I went to a little bitty church. But what I noticed within the context of youth groups and college ministries and stuff was, it seemed a lot of the time when a young man would display some leadership skills, he would be sort of fast tracked into a, hey, you need to think about going to seminary. You need to think. And it would be like putting these responsibilities on that young man within the church, which is obviously is appropriate. But not always thinking, are there other areas? How else is this guy gifted? My mind goes immediately to like the political sphere, because one of the issues that we've had within the church is just the complete lack of political engagement, often because I think that leadership is sort of reserved. Well, pastoral, that has nothing to do with the world. That has nothing. We need to, if you show leadership skills, then we need to get you on a track So you need to go to seminary. You need to go to, usually it would, like in the Baptist circles, it would be like Bible college, seminary. And then you take a church, who knows where, with no connection to your hometown, away from all your people. And then it wouldn't necessarily go super well. But what perspective do you have on that?
I absolutely agree with you on there being sort of a plague of misplaced callings due to someone who is on fire for the Lord and does display certain leadership skills. Because people assume that if you're like a young man and you're interested in theology and you're not like alone in the corner just doing your own thing, oh, he needs to be a pastor. But there's way more to being a pastor than theology. When we conceptualize theology, at least in the Reformed tradition, you know, as Van Maastricht lays out in his large work of systematic theology, he conceptualizes theology as theoretical practical. So it's not just theoretical. It's not just musings about God. It's not just practical, but it's theoretical practical, which means that there's like theory involved. There's theology about how we conceptualize God, how we conceptualize his words, how we interpret the scriptures. But then there's also the practical. How do we apply this to daily life? And oftentimes from everything that I've heard from those that are in pastoral ministry, the practical is what is the most at play. Like you just said, like 80% of ministry is counseling. And the thing is that there are a lot of people that are really into theology that couldn't really give much of a care towards pastoring in like in a way that's like involves counsel. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Lay people should read and study theology. It's good. It's good for your growth. It's good for teaching your children, because whether they like it or not, everyone has to be a little bit pastoral, especially if you're a father. Even mothers will teach their children the faith if dad's away and she's at home or something like that. So that's an important thing for every Christian to have, but not everyone is necessarily called to the pastorate. And part of the way that I realized I did have a calling was like, you know, I've kind of been like a theology nerd for a bit. but I kind of realized that maybe there's a call to ministry when I kind of left my mega church environment, got plugged into a much smaller church of about 120 congregants. And I realized, I'm like, okay, I could talk to these old ladies about their flower gardens and not look absolutely bored out of my mind. And hey, I'm not actually that bored. I mean, could I talk about something else and enjoy it more? Probably. But I mean, like feeling that unique love and care for the people in the body of Christ outside of just, oh, do you want to talk about infralapsarianism and superlapsarianism? Do you want to talk about the differences between diachronic and synchronic right. contingency and all these other gobbledygooks terms and all that? That's kind of where I realize that. And not every young person who's into theology necessarily is called to do that. Maybe they're just a Christian. Maybe they just really love Christ and want to learn more about them, as every person in the church ought to want to do. And so there's definitely like this plague of misplaced callings for that purpose. And it's important to be able to scope that out. And even if you are considering going to seminary, going into ministry, it's something that you have to keep in your mind. And something that I do want to say, kind of back to when we were discussing RTS Orlando, is that you don't need to go to seminary to get theological education. First off, you can read books on your own. But not only that, RTS actually has an app that has all of their lectures recorded for each class, except for the language classes, I believe, because that's a little bit harder to like track along with unless you're there in person or doing a very like intensive online class where the professor can actually talk to you and things of that nature. But you can download the app and listen to all the lectures. You can look up the syllabi and get all the books and just read them. There's plenty of, and RTS makes it clear. It's like, yeah, if you can't come here, look at this stuff. And you don't need to pay a dime for it. So if someone's really into theology but doesn't feel called to that, they can get basically like nearly everything from a seminary education can offer just off your phone. That's part of the blessing of modern technology, is that we can do something like that. But yeah, I definitely believe that there's a mistaken calling for people that are oftentimes just seeking to pursue Christ and learn more about him. So you're absolutely on the money about that.
Yeah, I want to kind of get your thoughts specifically about one thing that I think that you don't agree with here. And I'm not really sure. I kind of get the analogy, but you know, I think it's a decent analogy, but I'm not totally sure. But before that, when you're in a church, you're connected to a church. I'm not really sure. I don't know what your plan is after you're done with seminary, if you plan to go back to the church that you were at, if it is sort of, I know you're in a denominational system, so that will determine probably a lot of that. But what I've seen over the years, I know, is especially, I mean, I come from a non-denominational background, but what I've seen a lot of is there will be people in a church who will pour into that church, and they really will become integral. And they really, you know, if they have good leaders, then they can learn theology. Because if you have a good pastor, some good elders who really understand biblical doctrine, and, you know, maybe even languages. Languages is harder because that's a very academic thing. I've wanted to learn Hebrew and Greek for a long time, but you have to sit down and hit the books. And you know, when you got a full-time job and a family, like you have to really prioritize for that. You're not too many people are going to be up at, you know, midnight studying Greek. It's not going to happen. So there is.
I'm so glad that I am single as I went through my Greek 1 intensive and am currently trying to survive Greek 2. It's very helpful. Yes.
Yeah. This is one of the reasons I think why I didn't go to seminary. I was already married, but or I think at the time I was about to get married. I sat in a very prominent seminary. I won't name the seminary, but a very prominent seminary, there was a guy sort of doing a pitch, and he said, listen, all of you guys here, you all need to sell your house or get out of your house. You need to quit your job and need to come out here to this particular city where the seminary is, which is, you know, one of the most expensive places in the country. And you need to, you know, you need to go here for 3 years and then you need to sort of heed God's call. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, like, you know, you're making a pitch for your seminary and that makes sense, but mm-hmm. You're going to take these guys like out of their churches who have been, you know, a lot of these churches, like these are guys who are sort of lay pastors, like a lot of rural areas throughout the country. A lot of the time there aren't a lot of options, you know, you have to deal with the situation that you're in. Taking those guys away a lot of the time is, you know, may actually be worse for their churches, especially if they may never be back. But I've seen a lot of that, and I wonder sometimes if, because I've also known quite a few guys who would be involved in a church and would go to seminary, and then when they came back, you know, knowledge puffs up. It was like they were a different person. It was sort of like that down to earth was gone, and now it's like, well, you know, I've been to seminary, and then there would be this disconnect. So to sort of bring it back to this piece, let me. Put it back up here. So he basically, what he's arguing in this case is that the seminary model, like the modern seminary model, I think he makes a reference to like oppression school system. So sort of because our school system adopts a lot from, you know, it's a Western European model sort of that we employ, which, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that we're in the Western tradition, but that it doesn't necessarily, like it's different than Jesus and his disciples. Like that was sort of a life on life thing. Does that analogy hold, or are you not buying it?
Yeah, I mean, when we think about it historically, I don't really, I mean, I understand a lot of the critiques of the seminary system. I think many of them are warranted. But this whole idea of going off to school, like to learn, is nothing really particularly new. I mean, I think about the call of the apostles. They had to abandon their jobs and sometimes their families in order to follow Christ. And, you know, some people will be like, oh, well, the apostles didn't go to seminary. Well, they were taught by the incarnate word. I think that settles their seminary education, if you ask me. But, you know, if to be taught directly by Christ in your presence, where you could literally poke, touch him, things like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so even then, there were prominent schools established very early on. Like there's the School of Alexandria that people from across like Christendom would go to attend to learn at. I mean, Irenaeus came from or went to Gaul to teach. And he was I think he was a North African. You can correct me if I'm wrong, if you know. I don't recall, but he traveled up to Gaul to teach the people there. People were always traveling. You think of the Reformation period. John Knox from Scotland went to learn from Calvin. Peter Martyr Vermigli, who was an Italian, he obviously had to flee because he was being persecuted, but he uprooted himself and went all the way to England to teach at Oxford. So this is nothing really that new. I understand why it can be concerned, especially if you're already in a pastoral position. But this idea of traveling in order to get a theological education is nothing really that new in the Christian tradition. But I would definitely say that there is a benefit towards being able to learn in your particular context, in a more local context, which again, as I stated before, is part of the reason why I went to the seminary that I'm at. It's only 2 hours away from where I'm from. I am living up here, but I can literally just, if I need to get to Tampa for some situation like Hurricane Milton, I was only able to drove for 2 hours and I was here. Before I left for seminary, I was given the opportunity to actually preach at my church. And my pastor had told me, yeah, if we ever need you to fill in again, we'll give you a call or something. And so I can just drive down 2 hours. So I think there is a benefit there. There is an importance, I think, in being able to travel to learn directly from people who are incredibly insightful theologically, who can teach you. And this also gets into the purpose of seminary as well. I don't think, as I was stating earlier, the primary context in which you learn how to be a pastor will be the ecclesial context, I believe. And the thing is that you'll be learning a lot of wisdom principles when you're at seminary, but the primary place where you're going to be ingrained is the local church. And I think that's incredibly important. And that's why pastoral internships and things like that are so important. That's what I would say about that. I don't know if there's anything else on there, but we can get on to the weak theology of calling portion, unless you had any other comments you'd like to make.
Well, there was one thing that he did discuss that I was like, oh man, that's like spot on. I know of so many examples of this, but he was talking about, hey, you know, there's a guy who's, in my town or at the church that I go to, and he's saying he really wants to be on the mission field. I'm kind of like, well, hey, you know, there's stuff to do here right now. Do you want to go? And he's like, no, I can't need. And his point was basically like, do you really expect that your calling is going to be realized if you are in a completely different context? Which is why I think it's important what you're saying about proximity and locality, because, I wrote a piece last week about the flooding in North Carolina. And I think one of the things I put in it was a lot of the time, you know, when you get on a plane and you fly to, you know, the other side of the world, which there's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. Again, everyone has different callings. So, God calls people to different missions and different ministries. He didn't call Hudson Taylor to the same thing that he called John Calvin, right? John Calvin went to a very specific place, was in a very specific place teaching for a long time. Hudson Taylor was in China, right? So, callings are not the same for everybody. We load up planes, we fly to the other side of the world, and we will be flying over all this ministry that we could be doing. And you know, I wouldn't want to make it about dollars necessarily, but like we could do it like right now. Like we could all load up in vans and go, and you know, like with the flooding, it's something that a huge portion of the country is really close to. So I was kind of like, hey, let's go help with this thing. But there's nothing wrong with, you know, missions is great. But I spent some time on the mission field and I rubbed shoulders with quite a few people who really believe that calling would be realized if they just got out of their local context. And kind of what I learned was, you're going to be exercising your spiritual gifts in your local context. And if you're not, don't expect that it's going to go well for you when you're on the other side of the world. So that was just sort of an aside that I took from his analogy. But one thing I did want to just, I want to plug another piece actually. So this is from, because it kind of ties into this whole thing. This is from Dusty Devers. So he wrote about this subject specifically last year. It's called 7 Categories for Evaluating a Pastoral Calling. And he goes through, constitution, he must be a he. So if you're a woman, I'm so sorry. True. You know, you can be a Methodist, I guess, but yeah. Commitment, compulsion, right? So that's kind of what I was just talking about. Character, you know, that gets into deacon elder qualifications as well. Competency is vital. Confession, you need to be, you know, aligned with an Orthodox confession. And then circumstances. So the circumstances of your situation, which is sort of what you're talking about, are going to be different. There are probably situations where maybe the best option, like for a pastor training up somebody in his church, is to really just pour into a guy that could take over his role. You know, you think of a pastor who has cancer, he doesn't have long left. Does it make more sense to just kind of grab a guy out of seminary who's just sort of ran, or that guy that he's been discipling for 20 years, who is ready to take over that role? What makes more sense in that circumstance? Then there's other circumstances, man. Maybe it's this is going to be a cultural thing too, because some places, if you don't have a degree, if you don't have that those letters, whether you like it or not, they're people just might not listen to you at all. Other places, if you have them, they might not listen to you at all. So, you know, it's good to know your particular circumstances in your calling, but it's not a merely mystical thing. There's very tangible things that God orchestrates in your life to make these things, you know, clear. So I don't know if you have anything to say about that. I had one other thought.
I absolutely agree on the circumstances part for sure. But yeah, I don't think I have too much to contribute there.
So one thing that you did mention, and I'm just going to, so if you want to check out that article, go ahead. And you know, it's something worth, I think, having a conversation about. That was one of the main points in running it. A lot of people are trying to figure out, do I go to seminary? Do I not? And a lot of churches are trying to figure out, man, where do I get pastors? Like if I need a pastor for my church, where do I even, you know, how do I know who to choose? Should I just get some guy from some seminary? Who do I trust? One thing that in the beginning I was kind of talking about how I think there's a dissonance, there's a kind of a divide between the expert class and the layman. And we see that playing out in so many different facets of our society and our culture, but we see it in the church as well. And one thing that I think I would just caution, because, you know, we have a lot of pastors who read TruthScript and listen to this podcast. So one thing that I would just put out as something to think about, and maybe something to take away from this piece in particular. So Matt, you talked about like theology nerds. So like a place for, you know, like you do need this place for like theology nerds to kind of do their nerding, which, you know,
they need to spur out somewhere.
Right. But within churches, you don't want that divide to exist, if at all possible. And I think it's very, very tempting, or not tempting, but it's, I guess, typical, that your church leadership can very easily be orientated toward a particular type of Christian that fits kind of into that expert class. What do I mean by that? If the only guys in your church are guys that this is sort of an economic thing in a way. The jobs now, I'm just going to come right out and say it. The jobs that pay well in 2024 are tech jobs. They are programming. They are coding, things like that. So something that I think is happening, especially in suburban areas, is the guys who end up having time because they're not crushed economically. Like they're not out like working two jobs. And so they tend to have more time. They actually can actually put into the church more. Often tend to be guys who kind of will fit into the sort of theology nerd category. Maybe they're more bookish. Maybe they're more, maybe they just have more time to do those kind of things. But don't disregard or forget the more like blue collar guys in your congregation. You need them to also be involved. And you may have guys in your congregation, I think, that maybe they aren't capable of you know, talking as lofty or expressing theological constructs and concepts to you know, a certain level, but God still may have given them a lot of wisdom. They may have a lot of life experience that's really valuable for your congregation. You kind of need both. You want the people in your congregation to, I don't know if representation is the right word, but I don't know if I'm making sense, but you want to try to make sure that that you're not specifically prioritizing a certain type of Christian in a cultural sense.
Yeah.
Within your church leadership. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. That's good. But yeah, I don't have anything else to contribute to the article other than adding the addendum that I am a young man and a seminary student. So whatever words I've spoken, take with a grain of salt. This guy has more wisdom than me, most likely. But yeah, no, I've appreciated this conversation. I enjoyed reading the article. It gave me a lot to think on and chew on, especially as someone who is in seminary right now. So TrueScript, Mr. TrueScript right here. Thank you for publishing. I enjoyed reading it.
Yes. And thank you for coming on, Matt. I'm just going to do a quick plug for the website so that you find people know where to go for more. So TrueScript is a 501c3 organization. If you go here to the bottom of the screen, if you're interested in publishing with us, I can't guarantee you that you're going to get published, but if you'd like to give it a shot, take a look at the guidelines and our content style guide. I have tried to make this, we came up with the style guide. We've tried to make it as user-friendly as possible. We also give you ideas of the kind of things that we would like to publish. If you want more specificity, feel free to shoot us an email at truthscript23@gmail.com. And I'll be happy to if you think, hey, this is a good, I'd like to write about this, then feel free to shoot an email. We are also a 501c3 organization. If you would like to help keep our lights on, keep us continually expanding and doing bigger things. We just had a conference. You can also donate to us with the donate tab. Hopefully we should soon have a rolling donation so that if you want to go donate on a consistent basis, like a monthly basis, then you can do that as well. I just want to thank everybody who has donated. You have made a lot of this possible. You have made Matt's microphone possible. It's been fantastic, and I appreciate it so much. God bless everyone. Have a great night.
Take care, y'all.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.